This Is Your Life, Season 1, Episode 12. Welcome to This Is Your Life with Michael Hyatt, where our goal is to give you the clarity, courage, and commitment you need to do what matters. My name is Michelle Cachette, and I'm your co-host today, and I'm sitting in the studio with Michael Hyatt. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Michelle.
You know, we all have influence. Whether we know it or not, we're constantly influencing the people around us. The clerk at the grocery store, our child's teacher, our neighbor, the person that we pass on the road that maybe we cut off in traffic. We have influence for good or for bad. But influence doesn't always equate to leadership, does it?
No. Every leader is influential, but not every person who is influential is a leader. And the way that I distinguish those two is what your intent is. In other words, anybody can be a leader because we're all influential in ways that we don't fully appreciate. But the person who is intentionally influential is going to use their influence for good, to influence a person to help them grow, get what they want, become what they were meant to be. That's a leader.
And that's really in the other person's best interest, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right, so today we're going to talk about how to know if you're a leader. 12 ways to know for sure. I mean, I think most of us want to feel like we're somehow leading or influencing for good, doing something positive. But then there are times I go, am I really a leader? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, even if you've been leading for a while, sometimes you wonder. But we're going to answer all that and more.
So today we're going to provide 12 ways for you to know for sure whether or not you're a leader. Let's just dive right in, since we have 12 of these to get through today, and start with the first, what I call, this is the evidence, right? So
yep.
Kind of like searching for the evidence, we're going to talk about the different pieces of evidence that show us whether or not we're a leader. What is the first evidence?
The first one, and these, by the way, aren't in priority order, but these are just 12 of these I thought of a while back. And the first one is you long to make a difference. Leaders are never happy with the status quo. They got to change things. And you should never hire, by the way, a leader to do anything if the status quo is acceptable to you. Leaders are hired. Leaders are made to, in effect, change. And so if you have that something within your chest that's beating that says, I want to make a difference. I want to have an impact. I want to shift something in the world for somebody else, you might be a leader.
And it's different than wanting to make a difference is different than just wanting to have a bunch of people around you that think you're cool.
Oh, exactly. That's no sign of leadership whatsoever. A real leader doesn't care so much if he gets the credit. He really just wants to see the difference.
Such a key point. I love that. Okay, so what's another evidence or another way that you can know that you're a leader?
Yeah, this one is related to the first one, but it's different. And that is you're discontent and dissatisfied with the status quo. When I was in the corporate world, I remember one time I was talking with one of my colleagues, and he said to me, my assistant wanted to know, and she asked me this, and I don't know how to exactly bring this up, but why are you so discontent with the status quo? Why can't you just leave things as they are? You keep messing with things that we've already got in place. And he thought this was a legitimate complaint. And I said, look, that's why I exist. I mean, there's no system that's created that can't be improved. And that's true for the systems I create. And I am very discontent even after I create something that I love at the time. And you and I were talking mm-hmm. about this. You get on the plane after you've spoken somewhere and delivered a talk and you'd think you'd be worn out about it. I'm already retooling it for the next time I'm going to give it.
Uh-huh.
Because I already have that discontent. I feel a sense of satisfaction. I can own and appreciate what I've done, but I'm always wanting to tweak it. Well, that's leadership. It's that discontent with the way things are, always just a little step ahead in terms of vision of what things could be or might become.
Initiative, and this is actually the third evidence or third way you can know you're a leader here, is another key piece of kind of identifying leadership within. Talk about that for a little.
This is the third evidence. You're not waiting on a bigger staff or more resources to accomplish your vision. The person who's doing that is a bureaucrat. They're not a leader, because a leader understands an important principle, Michelle, and that is that vision always precedes the resources. The resources don't show up until the vision is clear. And once you understand this principle, it can change everything in your leadership. It can change everything in your business, in your marriage, everything else. The most important thing you can do is articulate where you're going And then it's almost magical, not quite, but the resources have a way of showing up. It may be money that you need, time that you need, staff that you need. But until you articulate the vision and get really clear on that, your boss is probably not going to walk into your room and say, hey, I just thought maybe you ought to hire a couple extra people. Could you use them? They're not going to say
that. Yeah, that's not going
to
happen.
Or I'm going to add $1 million to your budget. Do you think you could put it to good use? No. They're not going to give you more resources than your vision calls for. So you've got to start with the vision, and you can't wait.
Okay, let's move on to number four, the fourth way that you can know that you're a leader. What is that?
Yeah, it's your dreams are so big they seem impossible.
Oh, so that's not a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing.
I love to dream and come up with new ideas and things like that, but that's actually a good sign, especially if you want to be a leader.
Do you feel like when you're dreaming like that they're impossible?
Yes. I mean, I do. There's times, I have so many dreams, but how in the world am I going to accomplish that? Or, you know, what needs to happen? I mean, it's just too hard or it seems too big, but I love to dream it anyway.
I do too. And I think that's a mark of a leader. I get discouraged sometimes when I'm thinking about some big dream that I want to accomplish and I don't clearly see the path of how I'm going to get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
But what leaders do, what real leaders do, is they kind of obsess about the outcome. And again, kind of like when we're talking about resources, believing that the path will become clearer as they walk toward it. It's very rare for me to see the entire path from here to there. So what I see is usually the next couple of steps I got to take. And I believe, this is kind of a philosophical viewpoint, but I believe that if I'm faithful in what I've been given, that I'll be given more. So if I'm faithful to the light I've been given, the action steps that I know I can take now, that the other action steps, the strategies, the tactics, the resources, whatever it is I need to get there, will show up. But they always seem impossible. And they seem impossible, these dreams, because they're outside of our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not outside of your comfort zone, if your dreams are inside of your comfort zone, they're not really dreams.
Well, you're not dreaming big enough.
You're not. And they're not compelling, ultimately.
You're staying in a safe place. And real leadership doesn't always stay in that kind of safe circle. All right. What is the next evidence that you're a leader?
You acknowledge what is, but inevitably ask what could be. And this is a delicate balance because a real leader has what Jim Collins calls in Good to Great, the Stockdale paradox, which is, and this comes from Admiral Stockdale, whom I don't know if you remember, but he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 7 years. And I mean, he went through horrific things over a 7-year period. A lot of people came and went. He was finally released and a reporter got to him and he said, how did you survive? And he said, and more importantly, how did the people who did make it without losing their mind, how did they survive? And he said, well, they possessed two qualities. One is that they faced the most brutal aspect of their current reality. So they didn't try to dismiss it or they weren't Pollyannish about it, but they embraced their current reality for what it was. And in his case, I'm in a prisoner of war camp and it's horrible here. But on the other hand, they never lost hope for their ultimate triumph.
They maintained that vision.
It's those two things, and they're tough to hold on to. So you walk into a corporate setting, and you look at the world you have, and you go, I don't have enough resources, this product's broken, our customers are upset, whatever. You got to acknowledge that. Nobody appreciates a leader who walks in and tries to gloss over that or minimize it or dismiss it. That's not helpful. You've got to embrace it, acknowledge it, and all that. But you can't get stuck there because that breeds cynicism and that's not helpful to anybody, especially to your team. So what you've got to do is see what is, but in the context of what could be. Yes, we have these problems. And a question that I've often asked myself that really helps me make that transition is what does this, as difficult as it is, what does this make possible? Because there are sometimes in those really difficult, adverse situations where if we didn't have them, other things wouldn't become possible. And I can think back on a time when I was newly appointed as the president of Thomas Nelson, and literally weeks after it happened, I fell down the stairs in my house and broke my ankle. And I thought to myself, this is the worst possible time for this accident. I'm traveling around the country, I'm meeting with investors, and I don't need this to happen now. But then I started to ask myself the question after I got kind of past the initial shock and the discouragement of it to say, well, what does this make possible? Well, that was when I started my blog because I was laid up for a week after the surgery.
You
I
had
couldn't
some
do anything
free
else.
Time.
I got some free time. I got to almost always board first on airplanes.
Hey, now that is a huge benefit.
It did, because they let in the people that have got issues like that, you know, so I got on first. I oftentimes was upgraded to first class for free because I couldn't hobble all the way back to coach.
That's almost worth breaking your own leg.
That's right. I got firsthand experience of what it was like to be handicapped in a sense, very limited sense, but to see what it's like to have to traverse, you know, openings that weren't wide enough, or not having ramps and only having stairs and all that. So I kind of was able to see the world from a different perspective.
Yeah, empathy. You had a whole different kind of degree of empathy that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
So it made possible a lot of things. But so again, what does this make possible? Helps us see what's possible in the context of what is.
So you acknowledge what is, but inevitably you ask what could be. And you kind of live in that, kind of straddling that tension where you have one foot in one place, one foot stepping ahead.
You got to do both if you're a leader.
The next one is that you realize you don't have to be in charge to have significant influence. I love this.
This is a fantastic one. And this is one I first learned from John Maxwell.
Uh-huh.
And that is, your position does not equal leadership. Because you think to yourself, if I had that title, I'd be more influential. No. If I had that position, I'd be more influential. Some of the least influential people in corporations and organizations and ministries are people that have big titles, but they don't have much influence. And we talk about that in a little bit. Why? But they're not related. They're completely unrelated. And as long as, let me say this, they are related if you think they're related. In other words, if you think I can only be influential if I have a big title, you probably won't be influential. But if you think, you know what, I can influence people without that title, you can.
You know, I think it's even a kind of a stewardship kind of idea. There's a verse in the Bible that talks about that if you can be trusted with little, you can be trusted with much. So yes. I'd even go so far to say that if you can't be responsible for your influence in a non-titled position, your leadership in a smaller role or not a leadership role, then you can't be trusted to do it later either. So if you have that, that's great practice ground for you to be able to exercise that.
It is. And those are the people that get promoted too, because somebody watches and says, you know what? That person, we're going to promote them because they have influence. They're being a faithful steward of what they've been given. So let's promote them. And a lot of people hang back and say, well, I'm not going to do that job till I get the position. No.
But why would you promote them?
Oh, why would you promote them?
If they're
not
showing the initiative to do that now, why would you put them in a position of more responsibility and more influence, more leadership?
And the way that it works is exactly the opposite. If you want that new position, start acting yourself into that new position. Start doing those responsibilities voluntarily, and then the position will catch up with you.
Let's move on to the next one, the additional evidence here. I think we're on number 7, I believe, of our 12. And this is all about responsibility.
Yeah, it's this. And that is, you refuse to blame others for your circumstances and take responsibility for finding solutions.
Oh.
You know, playing the victim is much easier. When everything's outside of your control, you can just kind of dismiss it and just say, well, that's just the way it is, and I don't have to do anything. But when you refuse to blame others for your circumstances and you own them for yourself and say, look, this is my responsibility. Where I am in life, where I am in my career, is because of the decisions I've made right up until this point. Now, in a sense, this is hugely liberating, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the stuff is outside of your control, you can't change it. You know, you're a victim. But once you own it and say, I can control this, I can at least control my response, then everything becomes possible. I don't have to just yield to these unnamed, mysterious forces that are swirling about around me, but I can step into this and begin to change things by owning it. And I really have watched for that in my career. People that work for me, is, are they quick to blame or are they quick to own? Those are two different things.
And I remember, they cannot coincide.
They can't coincide. And it's a habit that we have to cultivate of taking responsibility. I'm not talking about false responsibility. Sometimes things happen outside of our control. You know, a customer complains, or they have a bad experience, or another department lets us down or whatever. But to own our response to that and get fixated on the solution and not being so worried about assigning the blame.
Boy, blame can be so poisonous to
Very
leadership.
Destructive.
I mean, and we can get in bad habits of kind of almost continually being on this loop of blame. And so we really, like you said, it's a habit. I mean, we've got to decide to stop it, change it, do something different.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, moving on. What is the next evidence that you know you're a leader?
Yeah, to foster unity by bringing people together and encouraging dialogue. You know, in some ways, I really hate organizational behavior because often it gets politicized. You know, people are talking about other people instead of to other people. And again, this kind of fosters the victim mentality where you stay stuck and the organization doesn't move forward. And a real leader, though, fosters unity by creating this dialogue where let's just bring together the people that disagree and let's engage in a conversation and seek to understand. Dr. Covey talked about this in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Seek to understand rather than be understood and find out what is their point of view. You know, instead of let's talk about them, let's talk to them. And wouldn't it be awesome if in this country, at least, I mean, this is the only country I live in, so I can't speak for the rest of the world. But in the U.S. where we live, everything has become so polarized. Everybody's talking about everybody else, at least in the political sphere, and people are not talking to each other. The two parties, for all I can tell, are not sitting down and having a conversation. And it's sad.
It is sad.
We all lose.
There's no growth can happen there.
But it brings us back to the point, what we need is leadership. You know, if we had leadership where somebody, anybody, would just say, look, let's sit down and let's talk. We have differences. We don't want to gloss over those. They're very real and they're very substantial. But, you know, even in a conversation, you have a choice of you can focus on where we're different or where we're similar. I went through this exercise one time with my team. It was at that seminar we talked about before, the Alignment Intensive, where sponsored by Gap International, gapinternational.com, if you want to go to the resource. We'll have a link in the show notes, but where we talked about this exercise of sitting with some people from other cultures, and there were about 80 different countries represented in the room. And we sat with somebody from another country and we said, okay, let's focus on all the ways we're different. So this was one part eight of the exercise. And, you know, it was everything from skin color to language to background to religion to all that. And you can kind of almost feel the tension rise in the room. And then we said, now let's focus on all the ways that we're the same. And, you know, do you love your kids? Yeah, I really love my kids. My kids are the most important thing to me. And, you know, you want to have meaningful work. And I mean, it was amazing.
Now that's powerful.
We had like a list that was 10 times as long of all the ways we were similar. And it brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, you know what? Our differences aren't that significant. They're real.
Mm-hmm.
But we can deal with those if we first identify how we're similar and how we're the same and how we have this overlap of interest.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, you talked about doing that with your team, but imagine how that would impact a family, a church. I mean, there's so many different ways to sit there and focus on how we're the same rather than focusing on all those differences, create that sense of unity. But the other piece about that I've watched you demonstrate this is just facilitating an environment of dialogue, allowing communication, not just allowing it, but encouraging it. It's such a key piece of that.
Yeah, good, good.
All right, moving on to the next evidence of how we know that we're a leader.
Yeah, you're quick to say, I messed up. Here's what I'm going to do to fix the problem I've created. I think back to a vice president that I had in the publishing world who, you know, to be honest, frequently messed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it wasn't enough where I questioned her competency, but she, like all of us, made a lot of mistakes. I think if you're a leader, you're going to make mistakes. Why? Because you're outside of your comfort zone. You're out there where the path hasn't been cleared. And you're creating a new path in the wilderness, so to speak. And so she was always the first, though, to come and tell me about the problem and to own it. And because of that, there was never any risk that I would get rid of her because she was too valuable to me. Now, contrast that with somebody in the corporate world who will never own their mistakes. It's always somebody else's fault. You know, they're quick to blame, slow to accept responsibility for their own actions. And those people are just not leaders. They're not cut out for leadership. I just know when I have somebody like that, they're not promotable. They're not going to get any more responsibility because they don't own what they have.
You know, for some reason, I remember as I was growing up or a young adult, I was so afraid to say I'm sorry because it was admitting failure. I didn't want to let anybody down. But
I finally
discovered that not doing that was letting people down.
Yeah.
I mean, simply saying I'm sorry and owning it is not the end of the world because there's a really high likelihood. And in fact, there's 100% likelihood that whoever you're talking to has failed themselves at some point
totally.
In time.
Have you ever experienced this with your kids?
Oh.
Where you've been tempted to kind of, you know, maybe the kids didn't notice, so I'm not going to acknowledge it, versus, owning it mm-hmm. with your kids?
Just before I left, I looked at my son, who's 17, and he's almost 6'3", so he's a lot taller than me. But I had blown it. I mean, just totally blown it as a mom. Had said something that I shouldn't have said, wasn't very nice. And I don't like leaving those things unresolved. Thank heavens. I wish I would have learned this early on as a mother, but now I'm finally at a place where I don't want to leave it unresolved. And I looked at him and I said, this is what I did. I shouldn't have done it. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?
Wow.
And, you know, it's still not comfortable to do it.
No. I mean, what happened though? What happened for him?
Oh, he looked at me, goes, of course I forgive you. And he immediately, you know, he's very loving anyway, just wrapped me in his arms. Of course, he had to bend over about 4 feet to hug me, but just wrapped me up in a hug, the longest hug, because, you know, for him, he just wants to connect and have a relationship. And right. me simply saying, I blew it, owning it, will you forgive me? And life goes on.
And the relationship's restored. He doesn't think less of you.
Not at all. In fact, I would even say it's not just a relationship restored. I would say the relationship is deeper because of
yes.
it.
That's what I think is counterintuitive. But what we have to practice is as leaders.
We think admitting failure is losing relationship, and it's actually growing relationship.
That's right. Yeah, I was listening the other day to Oprah Winfrey. She was interviewing Arianna Huffington, mm-hmm. who had written a new book called Thrive. It's been out for a few months now. But in it, Arianna was talking about her mother, and she said her mother always said that failure was a stepping stone to success. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, what a different perspective. Because we often think of failure kind of being the end game. You know, you fail, you're done.
Yes.
But to see it as a step on the way to progress is a different way of looking at it, and a way that we have to look at it as leaders, and we have to teach our team to look at it if they're going to grow.
Yeah, you know, and rather than it being an obstacle or inhibitor, it's actually a means to the end. Not that we want to
yes.
fail. We don't want to fail. We're still going to try to avoid it. But it's almost that necessary tunnel you have to push through to get to the other side.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's move on to the next evidence that you know that you're a leader.
Yeah, it is this, and that is that you value relationships more than tasks. This is hard for me because on the Strength Finders test, I'm an achiever, mm-hmm. which means I'm all about checking it off, moving on to the next task. I am very, very task focused. And even sometimes when I know I'm not supposed to be task focused, I'm supposed to be relationship focused, it's hard because I'm thinking in the back of my mind, okay, what comes after this? In fact, I'm thinking as we're having this conversation, what comes after this? Are you like that too?
No, you know, I love the relationships. I am somewhat, I guess at home, when I'm in my home environment, I can get very task focused
yeah.
for the most, yeah, I get focused on all that needs to be done. So if I'm in a really busy season, I am. Otherwise, I love relationships. So,
well, I don't mean this as a sexist thing at all, because I know there are exceptions to this, but I think at least in our culture, the way that we've been raised and everything, I think women are more naturally attuned to relationships and maybe men more to tasks.
Mm-hmm.
We all can think of exceptions to that. But I think it at least for the men that I know, this doesn't come easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, and this is why I believe also one of the gifts that I think women can bring to a team, to a leadership team, is that awareness of and value for relationships, and help the men celebrate a little bit more, realize that it's not all about the task, it's about the relationships. And ultimately, when you think about it, what you're trying to accomplish as a business or an organization or a ministry is it really does have a relational end.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about the task. It's the customers. It's the constituents. It's whoever you're trying to reach. It's relational at its core.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying this, by the way, just to remind myself,
mm-hmm.
as a very task-oriented person, what the point is. And so to remember for me that if somebody doesn't accomplish the task, that may be okay. But what's really important is that those relationships are enhanced and preserved, because that in a corporate setting is what's going to drive the results. It's the strength of those relationships that carries a team through.
So true. All right. Number 11. This is the 11th evidence that you can know that you're a leader.
This is a tough one, but it's so true. And that is, you walk your talk, not perfectly, but sincerely and intentionally. And it really goes back to the principle of self-leadership. Self-leadership always, always, mm-hmm. always precedes team leadership. If you can't lead yourself, you don't have the right to lead anybody else. And sometimes we're the hardest person of all to lead, just trying to get ourselves to do what we know is right and appropriate and expedient is difficult. but we got to walk our talk. We can't demand of others things which we're unwilling to do for ourselves. Did you ever see that movie, We Were Soldiers?
No, I haven't.
Had Mel Gibson. It was about Lieutenant Colonel Halmore, who was an incredible warrior. I can't remember. I think he was Army. But he led a very famous battle in Vietnam. And he promised to the soldiers, as they were at a stadium in the U.S. waiting to ship off to Vietnam, he said to them, he said, look, I can't promise, and I'm paraphrasing this, but he said, I can't promise that I'll bring you home alive. But he can I said, I'll promise you this. My boots will be the first to hit the field and the last to leave. And so then, like, one of the next scenes is him stepping out of a helicopter with his boot hitting the ground ahead of the troops. And when this horrific battle was over and so many men were lost, his boot was the last to come off. This was a man that was willing to do what he was asking the troops to do. He was leading by example. And this is so important as a leader, because it's much easier to tell people what to do than to actually do it. But to walk your talk is tough. I face this challenge every single day. You know, and I'm very aware of it, you know, when I'm with other people. You know, if I'm encouraging people to exercise, for example, am I exercising? If I'm encouraging people or saying to people that the relationship is more important than the task, then how does that work itself out in my own life? So we got to walk our talk. This is the most powerful component of leading in a compelling way and becoming a leader that others want to follow, is you've got to emulate. You're the first, how can I say this? You're the prototype of what you're trying to create. If you can't forge that in your own life and become the kind of leader worth emulating, not many people are going to follow you.
In an authentic way.
That's right.
Totally true to that. I just love that whole idea of congruency. You know, I agree with you. I'm the same. It's hard to walk our walk, talk our talk. I mean, because, you know, a lot of times what we purport is something that's we hope for and strive for. And it is, like you said, it's not going to be done perfectly, but we do need to constantly be striving for that.
Yeah, we do.
What's the last evidence that we're leaders?
Well, the last one is you're a learner. You read, listen to podcasts, attend conferences, ask other leaders lots of questions. There's this insatiable need to grow. John Maxwell's also said this, and I think it's right, and that's readers are leaders and leaders are readers. If you're not getting a steady stream of input, you probably don't want to grow. And if you don't want to grow, you can't lead, because leadership is all about creating growth in other individuals and in our organizations. So you've got to demonstrate that by becoming a learner yourself, always being teachable, always being willing to be instructed. I remember the first time I met, well, the only time I met General Tommy Franks. And I happened to be at a conference where I was speaking, and he spoke. Amazing, amazing speaker, but so teachable. I met him in the green room, and he started quizzing me, started asking me questions. And I'm thinking, you know, you've led the entire U.S. Army into battle, and here you're asking me, you know, as somebody who has limited corporate experience, these questions. And he was like that with everybody. He was just naturally inquisitive, asking questions. Talked about in his speech the books that he'd been reading, the conferences that he attended. And I think as a leader, we've got to be very intentional about that. We can't just leave that to, I'm going to read a book when I get time, or I'm going to listen to a podcast when I get time. Mm-hmm. Even conferences. And I'm very deliberate about this. My personal goal, and I do this every single year, is I want to attend 2 conferences as a participant, not a speaker, because I attend, you know, lots of conferences as a speaker. But to be there with my notepad, with my pen, sitting in the audience, on the edge of my seat, taking notes for how this can change my life. If I don't do that as a leader, then what happens is that I experience a limit, not only in my leadership, but where my team can go. I got to stay ahead of them. You know, I've got to be out there leading. And by definition, that means I'm ahead of them. I'm growing. I'm thinking new thoughts. I'm constantly adding to the team.
So now, as we've walked through all 12 of these evidences that we can know that we are leaders, one of the things that keeps coming to mind for me is how much of leadership is innate, or kind of just a part of internal, you kind of were born with this natural tendency toward leadership, and how much of it is developed or learned? Because some people really do seem to have a knack for it. And yet, if you don't feel like you're a leader, don't feel like you have the equipment to do that, is it possible to learn how to lead?
Totally possible.
So how much is kind of innate? How much is acquired?
Well, I think sometimes when people are talking about leadership, what they're really talking about charisma, they mistake charisma for leadership. And so I think there are people that are more naturally charismatic than other people. They walk into a room, they light it up, they just, people naturally look to them. But that's not leadership. In fact, Jim Collins also says, he says, you can be a successful leader without charisma or with charisma, but it's harder. Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Because it's tempting if you have charisma to coast on that or just kind of rest on your laurels. And instead of really learn leadership and become a student of leadership. So I think you actually do better if you don't have so much charisma, which is good news for people like me.
You have charisma. Come on. Well, I have really enjoyed today's episode talking all about the ways that you can know that you are a leader. If you enjoyed our conversation today, you can get all the show notes and the full transcript of this episode at michaelhyatt.com. In addition, if you'd prefer to watch the video of us recording this episode, you can also find the video at his website. Again, that's michaelhyatt.com. Do you have any final thoughts on this before we wrap?
Yeah, I would just say to anybody listening to this, I don't care where you're at, whether you're a brand new leader or you've been in the game for a while. Everyone, all of us, me, you, everyone, can take our leadership to the next level. And so I think these 12 evidences apply whether you're at the start or, you know, further along down the road.
Well, it's been our pleasure to have you with us today. Thanks for participating in this conversation. And until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Do what matters. On the next episode of This Is Your Life, Michael and I will wrap season one, and it's all about you. We're going to answer your questions.